Chapter 46. Jenna and I caught the morning flight to Miami. She was going to cab at home, but I talked her into letting me give her a lift. Driving out of the airport, I plugged my cell phone into the cigarette lighter and phoned my mother to let her know I was back. She was frantic. "I've been trying to reach you. Why didn't you answer your phone?"
"Battery ran out, I'm sorry."
"We got a package this morning."
"From them?"
"It's a videotape of your father."
"Have you watched it yet?"
"Yes."
I was almost afraid to ask, "Is he alive?"
"Yes," she said, straining. "Oh, Nick, he looks so awful."
I steered toward the exit for Coral Gables. "I'll be there in 15 minutes. Call Alex."
"I did. She's on her way here."
"Great. You did exactly the right thing."
She fell silent, as if collecting her composure. "It barely even looks like him," she said in a weak, shaky voice. "I almost didn't recognize him."
"I know it has to be a shock, but believe me, this is such good news. He's alive. We know he's okay." I was trying hard to lift her spirits, but she didn't respond. I was about to say more, then stopped. At that moment, words couldn't possibly have helped. I knew that the best thing was to let her have her cry. I steered with one hand and held the phone to my ear with the other, racked by the sounds of my mother's painful sobs. It was probably my longest drive home ever, but Mom had regained her composure by the time Jenna and I arrived. She and Alex were in the family room in front of the television. I was about to make introductions, but the women were ahead of me.
"I'm Alex," she said as she and Jenna shook hands. "We met once before at Duffy's." "I remember. I'm helping Nick with his lawsuit against the insurance company. We had to go to Bermuda."
"Bermuda? Huh? Tough assignment."
"Actually, it was all work, no play. You know how that is."
"Sure." I sensed a little tension, and it was only sidetracking us. "Let's watch the videotape."
"Good idea," said Mom. She popped it into the VCR. The women took a seat on the couch. I pulled up a bar stool from the counter.
The screen was blue. Mom had the remote in hand, ready to start.
"The whole thing is less than 30 seconds. There's audio, but they don't let your father say much. Most of the talking is from the kidnappers."
I nodded, signaling that I was ready. Mom hit the play button, the blue screen went snowy, and then the image appeared. Even my mother's sobbing on the telephone hadn't prepared me for what I saw. "My God," I said, completely involuntarily. They'd videotaped him indoors from the waist up. His face was thin, and his skin so lacked color that for a moment I thought the adjustments on the television set were off. Dad never had been able to grow a beard, so his unshaved growth looked especially shabby. His hair was dirty and uncombed. He showed little expression, neither a smile nor a frown. He was looking directly into the camera, then lowered his eyes and read from a prepared script. "This message is to my family," he began. I stepped down from my bar stool and walked to the set, drawn by his voice, as if compelled to be closer to my father's image. "I am being treated well. I will be safe as long as you obey all instructions." He laid the script aside and picked up a copy of El Tiempo, a widely distributed Bogota daily newspaper. The camera zoomed in on the headline and the date. 3 days old," I said. "That's pretty good." The camera zoomed out, again showing my father.
"It's interesting he's wearing only a T-shirt," said Mom. "I guess they're keeping him someplace warm."
"They do that to confuse you," said Alex. "I'm sure they're in the mountains." Back on screen, my father put down the newspaper, then seemed to turn to someone off camera, as if looking for instruction. "Freeze the frame," I said. Mom hit the pause button. I walked right up to the screen and checked the side of his head. The rest of the video had shown him straight on only, but these last few frames had caught his profile. "It looks like somebody did a pretty lousy job of stitching up a good 3-inch gash on the side of his head." Alex came forward to have a look. "I'm afraid you're right." My mother let out a combined groan and whimper. It was time to move on. "Hit the play button, Mom." My father's image was on screen for only a few seconds longer, then it went black. "What's going on?" I said. Mom said, "This is the part where the kidnapper talks in Spanish." Alex took a notepad from her purse, ready to translate. I leaned closer to listen, as if that would help my mediocre Spanish. It was a man's voice, the same one Alex and I had heard over the shortwave radio in Bogota. I'd had no trouble understanding him then, but here he was speaking too fast for me to pick up every word. Mom and Jenna looked even more clueless. Alex was scribbling feverishly on a notepad. In 20 seconds he was finished. Mom switched off the tape. I was perplexed, not sure if I'd heard the last few words correctly. I asked Alex, did I hear him right?
Let me start at the beginning. He says that the radio contact scheduled for Sunday the 19th of November is cancelled.
What?
I hadn't caught that part.
She shushed me, then continued.
Mr. Ray has proved to be a difficult prisoner, she read. We will tolerate no more delays. We will contact you by radio in our usual place on Sunday, the 12th of November at sunrise. The safety of the prisoner can be guaranteed no longer if you do not pay $250,000 at this time.
$250,000? That's what I thought he said. They've come off their own demand.
Why would they do that? Asked Jenna.
It's like Alex told me from the beginning. Most kidnappers end up settling for about 10 to 15% of the initial demand. Dad's a pain in the neck, I said, smiling. They must want to cut through all the back-and-forth negotiation and get rid of him. God, I love him.
It's not what you think, said Alex.
I stopped cold. From the expression on her face, I knew that it wasn't time to celebrate. What do you mean?
The word for ransom in Spanish is rescate. That's not the word he used.
He said 250,000. Even I understood that.
They want 250 to keep your father alive. He didn't say they'd give him back. It's not a ransom. It's what they call a safety guarantee.
My mother looked ill.
What the hell kind of sickos are these people? Who ever heard of such a thing as a safety payment?
I've seen it before, said Alex.
Especially when a prisoner violates a rule or gets in some kind of trouble. From the looks of that gash on the side of Matthew's head, he's probably been more trouble than his kidnappers bargained for. This is absurd, I said. They expect us to hand over $250,000 for nothing?
It's not for nothing, said Alex. They'll kill him if you don't.
My mother looked at me, her face etched in fear.
What do we do?
The room was spinning. I was so upset, I went to the window and looked out of the yard. What choice do we have? I said quietly. Chapter 47. Sunday came too soon. Even with my father's life hanging in the balance, pulling together $250,000 had proven more difficult than expected. My parents had poured their life savings into the seafood company, and with my suspicion of Guillermo still running high, he was the last person I wanted to be beholden to for money. I considered trying to borrow against the insurance policy, but Quality's allegations of fraud made that worthless as collateral. I ended up taking a second mortgage on my house in the Grove. J.C. gave me $10,000 of his own money, a true lifelong pal. And Jenna loaned me another $30,000. Cash advances from credit cards filled in another 19. Financially speaking, I was about as liquid as dried cement. And we were still $50,000 short. Physically, getting all that cash out of the country was a logistical and legal problem in itself. The money was wired to a Colombian bank, which by law could give us only pesos. Alex had sources in Bogota who could change the pesos back into dollars. I didn't ask how it would work. I wasn't sure I wanted to know. Was it this cold the last time? I asked. It was almost 5 a.m. Alex and I were huddled at the same picnic table that we'd used for the last shortwave communication with the kidnappers behind the old church atop Monserrate. It was damp but not raining, though the fog was so thick I couldn't even see the city lights of Bogota nearly 600 meters below us.
It was even colder. You just don't remember.
She was probably right. Who could blame me for having blocked that experience out of my mind? I paced for nearly 20 minutes. Last time we'd spotted a half dozen sightseers at this same hour. This morning offered no views, however, and the hikers had stayed home. The observation deck near the old church was empty, itself nearly invisible in the fog. Even the moon and stars found the blanket of fog impenetrable. Flashlights were our only source of light. The shortwave radio rested on the picnic table, emitting only static and garbled noises. Alex listened for any signs of reception. Finally, a hint of dawn filtered through the clouds, just enough to make the floating mist glisten. The faint light of morning gave the fog an eerie density, slowly changing the mountaintop from a black, claustrophobic place to a swirling, mystical setting within the clouds. It was sunrise, and as if on cue, the radio crackled. The familiar voice was back, the man who called himself Joaquin. "Good morning, Ray family," he said in Spanish. "Are you there, Alex?" She grabbed the microphone. "We're here. Go ahead." "You received my tape, no?" "Yes, very nice work. I think there's a future in music videos for you." "What?" "Nothing. I have the son here with me. His Spanish is good, but he wants to be sure he doesn't miss anything. So if you want your money, we're going to do this in English this time." "Very well," he said, switching to English. "But I hope you are as cooperative as I am. Do you have the money?" "It's in the city." "Don't give me that," he said harshly. "The videotape was very clear. It must be paid today." "You didn't expect us to bring it all the way here, did you?" "I warned you, no more delays." "Don't sweat it. You can have it today, $100,000. $100? I said $250. My heart was in my throat. I knew we were going to have to do a little horse trading when I'd come up $50,000 short on his original demand. But the simple fact was, we weren't talking about horses. "This is not a wealthy family," said Alex. "We have $100,000 and we had to scrape to get it. Come on, Joaquin, you're a smart guy. You know as well as I do that nobody pays $250 for a mere guarantee of safety." He didn't answer right away. Alex and I exchanged anxious glances, and I wondered if her counteroffer of $100,000 was pushing too hard with double that in our war chest. The silence was insufferable. At this juncture, even the slightest pause made my stomach flop. Finally, the radio crackled with a response. "Go to Hotel Los Andes on Carrera 6, one block over from Plaza de Bolívar." I could breathe again. Alex gave me a thumbs up, then spoke into the microphone. "That's in La Candelaria, no? Lots of inexpensive hotels in that area." "Correct. This one is small and has no private baths. There's a shared bath in back, right next to the rear entrance to the restaurant. At 3 o'clock, take the money into the men's room. Enter the third stall and check behind the toilet. You'll find a note that tells you what to do. Is that clear?"
"Yes, clear."
"That's all for now, then."
"Hold on," said Alex. "We need something in return."
"You're getting plenty. The prisoner's safety is guaranteed."
"We need a date. When will he be released?"
"He's not being released for anywhere near $100,000.
"Claro, but let's call that the first half."
He laughed. "Alex, mi amiga, you're dreaming."
"I told you before we aren't going to pay $3 million.
"You'll pay," he said, losing his chuckle, "unless the widow prefers to have her husband's heart hand-delivered in a plastic bag."
"Don't threaten us."
"Then don't con me," he said angrily. "I'm letting you off cheap here, but the ransom is firm. We know he has insurance. It's $3 million, not a penny less."
A sick feeling washed over me. We'd suspected that they knew, but this was the first time he'd come right out and said it.
"It's not as clear-cut as you think," said Alex.
"It is for me. The final exchange will be very soon. The details will be in the note you pick up this afternoon. That's all I have to say."
"Wait, one more thing. We need proof that he's alive."
"We just sent you a video."
"We want proof he's alive today."
"No es posible. The prisoner is not here with me."
"Put the proof in the note that you leave in the bathroom."
"What proof?"
"We want a proof of life question answered." He groaned, then said,
"All right, what is it?"
"Just one second." She looked at me and asked, "You know any secrets about your dad?"
"Like what?"
"It has to be a question that Joaquin can pass along to your father, something that only your father would know."
"What's his favorite color?"
"Nothing subjective," she said. "Make it a verifiable fact."
"How about the question we used the last time, the name of the golden retriever I had when I was a kid?"
"I need a new one. They could have asked him that 2 weeks ago and killed him yesterday."
"What's his wedding anniversary?"
"No good. If their plan was to kill him and pretend he was still alive, they surely would have gotten every birthday and anniversary out of him before pulling the trigger."
Put on the spot, I couldn't think of anything. I sensed urgency from Alex. Finally, it hit me. The drowning that Jenna had told me about.
"How old was his sister when she drowned?"
"Perfect," said Alex. Immediately, I wanted to retract it, but Alex was already passing it along to Joaquin. He wrapped things up with a simple, "Adios, amigos."
Alex switched off the radio, took one look at my expression, and asked, "What's wrong?"
"That question I asked you to pass along to Joaquin. It's not a good one."
"Nonsense. It was exactly the kind of thing Joaquin wouldn't be able to find out unless your father was alive to tell him."
"The problem is, Dad never told me about his sister."
"You mean you don't know the answer to your own question?" she snapped.
"I know the answer, but it's something that my father never shared with me. It's obviously a subject that he has difficulty talking about, maybe even something he just didn't want me to know. The last thing I wanted to do was ask a proof-of-life question that upsets him."
She stowed the radio in her backpack, threw it over her shoulder.
"Don't take this the wrong way, but your dad has more things to worry about than whether his son knows or doesn't know his personal demons. 3 million more things, to be exact."
I couldn't argue.
She turned and started down the stone trail. I followed, the two of us descending deeper into the fog.
Chapter 48. Matthew's head was still smarting. The blow he'd taken from the rifle butt during the attack at the river had rendered him unconscious for nearly a full day. The 3-inch gash had been crudely stitched by Aida, a 13-year-old girl of a gorilla who claimed to know how to sew. She knew nothing about the need for sterilized needles, however, and trying to get the wound properly cleaned and bandaged was about as likely as room service. All day long, Matthew would search himself for a few square centimeters of clothing that weren't covered in grime, and then he'd dab the pus away. It galled him to think that after all he'd been through, he could seriously end up dying from infection. "El vaso, por favor," he said to a passing guard. One of these lowlifes had stolen his only possession, a cracked rice bowl that he'd been using to collect clean rainwater, both for drinking and for washing his head wound. The guard just kept walking, not his concern. Matthew could easily have exploded, but he forced himself to remember that he was better off this week than last. He was out of his hole in the ground, though still held separately from the other prisoners. He spent his days beneath a stretch of canvas behind the gorilla's smoky hut, while the others were housed on the other side of the slope in army tents that had come with the last mule train of supplies. He'd seen Nisho once, but only from a distance. He'd passed the entire group on his way to a bathroom break. Jan, Emilio, the old-looking Colombian, and Rosa were seated around a small fire eating. Nisha was off to the side by herself, curled into a ball beneath a blanket. It was hard for him to say how long it had been since the rape. The weather was in such a cold, drizzly pattern that one day was utterly indistinguishable from the next. He wished for a pen and paper just to mark the passage of time. The guards who brought him food or took him to the latrine would generally tell him nothing. He would ask how long he'd been in captivity, what day it was, how many days till Christmas. Their response was always along the lines of, "¿Qué te importa?" What does it matter to you? It had gotten to the point where he just didn't talk to the gorillas and they didn't talk to him. Except for this morning. A few hours after dawn, Aida had brought him breakfast, the usual slop. Silence was the normal routine, but this time she'd placed the tin at his feet and, out of the blue, asked the strangest question.
"How old was your sister when she drowned?"
It had so completely thrown him that, instinctively, he almost asked her to repeat it. But he was certain he'd heard her correctly.
"Who wants to know?"
"Your son. Now answer the question."
7, he replied.
Without another word, she turned and left. Elation had been his immediate reaction. The videotape had been a good sign of progress, but this question from Nick was the first real confirmation that his family was in contact with his kidnappers. All along, his biggest fear had been that his wife and children wouldn't know whether he was dead or alive, and that not knowing would make their lives an even worse hell than his. As the morning passed, the elation gave way to more complicated emotions. His sister's drowning had always been a very private matter, one he'd never even mentioned to his son. It disturbed him to know that Nick was aware of it, and he worried what exactly Nick had been told about the whole horrible incident. His mother had her version. The coroner had another. For Matthew, the worst version of all was his own, because it was the truth. And he'd seen it with the eyes of a 5-year-old boy. It was raining again. Heavy drops pattered loudly atop his canvas tarp. The pattering was softer in the background, a soothing sound of a light shower on the jungle canopy. He stared off to the middle distance, letting his mind escape this place. Part of him resisted, but he needed to go back to that rainy morning in the Florida Keys. Almost 50 years ago.
"Run, Stacy, run!"
Matthew was struggling to get free. His drunken old man sprawled on the floor and pulling at his ankle. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw his mother rising from behind the couch, her nose bloodied. She lunged forward and kicked his father in the groin. He yelped, but it had worked. Matthew was suddenly free. His mother wrestled his old man down the way he'd seen her do it so many times before. She held him in a contorted hammerlock with his left arm behind his back. His right arm she pulled straight down between his legs and out the backside like an inverted tail. Anytime he squirmed, she tugged, and he felt it right where it hurt most.
"Go, kids,"
she shouted. Matthew froze. His mother was a small woman, and he knew she couldn't hold a man as big and drunk as his father for long.
"Mom, no. I said go," she shouted.
"I'll kill you," his father growled. "I'll kill every one of you bastards."
"Take your sister and go,"
his mother shouted.
"But, Mom,"
she locked eyes with her son, her face straining with intensity.
"Listen to me, Matthew. Go right now. Go far away."
He didn't want to leave her, but he never disobeyed her. He grabbed his sister by the arm, and together they ran out the door. They raced down the stairs, across the lawn, and into the street. They were sprinting at full speed in the rain, Matthew leading his sister by the hand. Stacy was still wearing nothing but the diaper her father had forced on her as punishment.
"Where are we going?" she shouted, her voice shaking as they ran. "Away," he shouted. "Mom said to go far away."
They were huffing and nearly out of breath as they turned down the wet, sandy road that led to the shore. Stacy was about to collapse as they reached the water.
"Help me," said Matthew. He was pushing a little fishing boat into the water. "What are you doing? We have to go far away. Mom said far away."
His feet sputtered in the sand. He pushed with all his strength. And finally the boat slid back into the water. The rain was falling harder.
"Get in."
Stacy jumped into the seat up front. Matthew was in back, tugging at the starting cord on the little outboard motor.
"Do you know what you're doing?"
"Mom showed me." One more tug and the engine started. He turned the throttle and the little boat roared away from shore.
"Matthew, slow down. We have to go far away. Mom said so."
The engine whined, the stern went down, and the bow rose as the boat headed straight into the gulf. The waves were beginning to crash. The rain and salty sea splash pelted their faces.
"Slow down," she shouted.
Matthew couldn't hear her. The wind was blowing harder, the engine straining just inches from his little ears. All he could hear was his mother's order, "Go away, go far away." A loud crack rocked the boat, and the sudden jolt sent him tumbling forward over the seats. Stacy screamed as she sailed over the bow and into the sea. The boat continued on its own till Matthew got his bearings and killed the motor. He was alone in the boat.
"Stacy!"
he cried. He tried to stand, but a large wave knocked him over. He grabbed the engine and scalded his hand, but it kept him from being tossed overboard. He glanced back and saw the buoy bouncing in the waves, and he realized that the boat had hit it at full speed.
"Stacy!"
The storm was intensifying. The waves were now whitecaps splashing into the boat. The sky had gone from gray to black. Sheets of rain were practically coming sideways, propelled by a chilly north wind. He stood at the back of the boat, his eyes searching frantically for any sign of his sister on the choppy surface.
"Stacy, where are you?"
He waited anxiously for her to shout back. He heard nothing, saw only wind, waves, and rain. Rain, more rain. Nothing but rain. Matthew stared blankly into the jungle, numbed by his memories, chilled by the endless cold mountain rain. His face was soaked, partly from the leaky tarp, but mostly from the tears that thoughts of his painful past had unleashed. Stacy's death had haunted him all his life. It had been an unspoken tension between him and his mother. Outwardly, she had always blamed her abusive husband. But another side had emerged with her Alzheimer's, her senseless but painful accusations that Matthew had killed his sister. He knew that it was the disease doing the talking, that she didn't really mean it. Still, one tragedy seemed to pile atop another in his life, all stemming from Stacy's drowning. It was his deep sense of guilt that had driven him to drink as a younger man, and it was the drinking that had led to the blow-up with his own 12-year-old son some 15 years ago. One stupid fishing trip, way too much alcohol, and their relationship was changed forever. He and Nick. Another tragedy at sea. The wound on his head was throbbing again. He removed his soggy boot and rinsed the pus away with rainwater, wondering what his son would think of him now. Chapter 49. We reached the Hotel Los Andes at 3:10. No need to ask where the shared bathrooms were. I just followed my nose, literally. The hotel was in the colonial barrio of La Candelaria, the oldest part of downtown Bogotá. The heart of the area was Plaza de Bolívar, the original town center, though the square itself was surrounded mostly by government buildings and modern architecture. The neighborhood to the east retained many old houses from the Spanish era. Some were restored and brightly painted, others dilapidated and on the verge of falling down. Scores had been converted into budget hotels that were popular with foreign travelers. Hotel Los Andes was on the lowest end of the spectrum. It hadn't seen a coat of paint in decades, and chunks of stucco had fallen from the walls. The roof was sagging, and those windows that weren't boarded up were covered with rusty iron security bars. A handwritten sign on the door offered rooms for the Colombian equivalent of about $3 American a night. I didn't need to go inside to tell that it would have been a rip-off at any price. We followed a narrow side street to the hotel's rear entrance. I carried the cash in a nylon backpack. Alex was at my side, armed with a concealed Sig Sauer P-228. Muggings happened every day in this area, but Alex assured me that anyone who made a play for my backpack was in for a 9mm surprise between the eyes. "You nervous?" she asked.
"Should I be?"
"Just remember what I told you. There's nothing you can do here today that is going to get your father released. This is all about showing the kidnappers that we can follow instructions. No heroics. Just go inside, get the note, and do exactly what it tells you to do." We stopped at the bathroom entrance. Behind us was the restaurant. Clanging kitchen noises filtered through the torn window screens. A sleeping drunk was on the doorstep, snoring. Sewage ran in a little stream from the bathroom to piles of garbage stacked high behind the restaurant. On a warm afternoon like this one, the mixture emitted a sweet, nauseating odor. "If I don't come out in 5 minutes, come in and get me."
"I was going to give you 2, she said.
"Thanks for the vote of confidence." I clutched the sack of money and entered the men's room. As the door slapped shut behind me, the immediate assault on my senses nearly knocked me off my feet. The place smelled like an open sewer. Along one wall was a trough urinal. It was clogged with paper and the scummy yellow-brown runoff from toilets that had overflowed. The wet floor had the same disgusting brown tint of watery feces. The lone sink was cracked and rust-stained. The wall above it showed the painted outline of a mirror that had evidently been stolen. In the back were showers for hotel guests. To my shock, 2 were actually occupied. I walked cautiously toward 5 dirty white stalls. The first one was empty. Behind the closed door of the second, I could hear a man struggling, presumably with his bowels. I stopped at the open door to stall number 3, the one Joaquin had designated for the drop-off. It had an old-fashioned toilet with a pull chain overhead. There was no toilet seat. The rim was splattered and filthy. Flies buzzed over the unflushed waste that had collected in the bowl. One thought consumed me. What in the hell am I doing here? It made me realize, however, that I couldn't possibly imagine the conditions under which my father had been living. In accordance with the kidnapper's instructions, I closed the door and checked behind the tank. There I found the envelope. I tore it open immediately. It was written in Spanish, but fortunately I could read my second language better than I could speak it. Stacy was 7 years old when she drowned, it read. I read that first proof of life sentence twice, almost in disbelief. This was for real, I realized. My father was alive. I continued to the next paragraph. Slide the money under the divider to the stall on your left. Say nothing. Information about the release of Matthew Ray will arrive in 90 seconds. If you leave your stall before then, or if anyone follows the money, you will receive no further information. To my left was stall number two, the same stall from which I had heard noises on my way in. With a discreet glance, I noticed a pair of feet beneath the divider. The groaner was here to take my money. My mind raced with thoughts of who this person might be. Alex had told me that kidnappers used mules for transactions like these, neighborhood kids who would deliver drugs, pick up ransom money, or do just about anything else for a few pesos. They were extremely reliable. If they screwed up or tried to run off with the loot, their entire family would be slaughtered. I held my backpack close to my chest, unable to move. I wanted to hop right over the flimsy partition that separated us and ask this stranger where my father was, but it would have been pointless. As Alex had said, the guy was surely a know-nothing mule. I took a deep breath, leaned over, and slid the backpack underneath to the other stall. The stranger picked it up. Instantly, a wave of conflicting emotions ran through me, from hope that the money would keep my father alive to hatred of these bastards for all the grief they had caused. Somewhere in the mix was the visceral sensation that I'd just been robbed. Even though Alex had talked him down to $100,000, more than half of my entire net worth had just passed to a total stranger beneath the graffiti-covered walls of a bathroom stall. Alone in the stench, I checked my watch and counted off the seconds until the promised arrival of further information. I heard the stranger's footsteps as he left, then the slamming of the bathroom door. 90 seconds passed, and I heard nothing. I waited another 15 and was beginning to feel scammed. I ran out of the stall and checked the one next to me. There was no sign of the stranger or of any forthcoming information. I raced outside and found Alex. Did you see him walk out? Who? The guy with my money. No one came out. I heard a door slam. There must be another door. Nick, don't try to follow. In 90 seconds, we were supposed to receive information about the final exchange. There's no one here. I ran straight to the back. Sure enough, beyond the showers was another exit door. I opened it and froze, struck first by the noise and activity, struck second by the irony. I'd assumed that my money would be laundered. I'd had no idea that the Hotel Los Andes shared bathrooms with a busy laundromat. A minute later, Alex was standing right behind me. Just let him go. How perfect, I said cynically. People come and go all day long with bundles in their arms. How would anyone know which one was walking out with my money in his basket? I'm sure it's just a mule. There's no point in tailing him. In fact, if he delivers the money and says we tried to follow, that's bad news for your father. We might never do the real exchange. Joaquin promised that the note would have information about my dad's release. The note said to wait 90 seconds and it would be here. Those sons of bitches gave us nothing. I believe this is what you're looking for, she said, holding a yellow sheet of paper. It was taped to the back of the door. I couldn't believe I'd missed it. I grabbed it and started reading, but I wanted to know the bottom line faster than I could translate. How much time did they give us to raise the money? She averted her eyes, a clear signal that the news was bad. A month? I asked hopefully. A week, she replied. That's impossible. Short of walking into the corporate headquarters of Quality Insurance Company with a gun, I can't resolve a claim dispute and have $3 million in a week. All the kidnappers know is that you have a policy worth $3 million. Then we have to tell them that the insurance company has denied our coverage. They'll think we're stonewalling. Or worse, they'll decide that your father isn't worth keeping alive. So what should we do? Next Sunday they expect us to be atop Monserrate for the next radio transmission. Maybe I should go alone and tell them you're working out a few details. Something minor but believable so they don't get concerned. It might buy a little extra time. How long do you think you can string it out? I wish I knew. I sensed that she didn't like her answer any more than I did. But no one had a crystal ball. God help us, was all I could say. Chapter 50. In a city of 8 million people, I felt completely alone. It was well after midnight, and Alex had retired to the master bedroom more than an hour before. A cozy bed awaited me in the guest room. Though our return flight to Miami was just hours away, I couldn't possibly sleep. I sat in the living room at the open window, looking out onto a relatively quiet street below. A faint nightlight from the kitchen left me in dim solitude. Headlamps from the occasional passing car sent shadows dancing across the living room wall behind me. One by one, the lights blinked off in the apartment buildings across the street. The minutes passed slowly, yet each time I checked my watch, I got the same sinking feeling that time was running out. I wondered how many others in Colombia were at that very moment living the same nightmare. Sudden shouting from across the street jarred me. A man and a woman in a second-floor apartment were arguing over something. On a balmy night with the windows open, sound traveled freely. After several heated minutes, it ended with the loud slamming of a door. I watched from my window as the man angrily left the building, his footsteps clicking on the old cobblestones below. "You still up?" asked Alex. I turned to see her standing in the hallway. "I think the whole neighborhood is awake now." She smiled a little, then crossed the room and sat in the white wicker armchair beside me, facing the window. She didn't wear pajamas. She was dressed in her preferred sleeping clothes, running shorts, and a rather skimpy athletic top that was little more than a sports bra. "Are you going to stay up all night?" she asked. "Probably. I'm worried about this deadline. I almost wish you hadn't pushed Joaquin for a release date. Don't you think it would have been smarter to leave it vague till we had some hope of scraping the ransom money together?" "I felt like I needed to push him today. We can't always appear to be stalling. If we do, that's dangerous for your dad." I looked out the window into the night, neither agreeing nor disagreeing. "Have you considered borrowing the money from Guillermo?" she asked. "Are you serious? I just wondered if you'd considered it, that's all." "I don't see how I can. After today, it's more clear than ever that someone told the kidnappers about Dad's insurance. If I had to guess who the rat was right now, I'd guess Guillermo." "Then you should definitely ask him to front the ransom money, play on his sense of guilt." "I'm not following you." "If Guillermo is behind this scheme, I firmly believe that he went into it thinking that the insurance company would simply cough up the money. Guillermo would take his cut, the kidnappers would get theirs, and your dad would come home safe and sound. It probably never occurred to him that the insurer would refuse to pay and that your father might be harmed." "Then why wouldn't he just call the whole thing off and tell the kidnappers to let my father go?" "Because he didn't team up with Mo, Larry, and Curly. I can tell from talking to this Joaquin that he's for real. One of his men even got killed pulling off the abduction in Cartagena. I hate to say it, but if somebody doesn't pay him, well, let's just say it wouldn't be good for your dad." I appreciated her discretion, but I knew what she was saying. "So let's say I tell Guillermo that there's no insurance money and that Joaquin's going to kill my father. What really makes you think he'd suddenly develop a conscience and pay the ransom himself?"
"I don't know. Some people call it instinct. Others call it the hostage negotiator's time-honored WAG method."
"What's the WAG method?"
"Wild ass guess."
Even as stressed as I was, I had to crack a little smile. "Gotta respect your honesty, lady." She returned the smile, though hers was even weaker than mine. She seemed to sense that I didn't really want to talk about it anymore.
We sat in the dim glow of the city lights, saying nothing. Her feet were up on a coffee table, long, bare legs bent at the knee. She'd probably considered her sleepwear more comfortable than sexy, but from my perspective, it appeared to be both. Not that I intended to do anything about it.
Suddenly, the street filled with the sound of an acoustic guitar. Alex rose and walked to the window. I joined her. "He's back," I said. "It's that same guy who was arguing with his girlfriend." He was sitting on the curb outside the woman's apartment, strumming his guitar beneath a street lamp.
"He's serenading her," said Alex. "Men still do that here. I think that's so romantic."
Together we listened as he wailed about his broken corazón and la mujer with the dark brown eyes who was the lost love of his life. It was unusual by American standards, but when la mujer actually came to the window to listen, I found myself pulling for him. "He plays a very good guitar," I said. The beat picked up. He made a skillful transition from the sappy love song to a more vibrant Spanish guitar that reminded me of the Gypsy Kings, though the sound was less full with a one-man show. Still, he was giving it his all. Alex started to move her hips to the music, then took my hand.
"Here, I'll teach you to dance, Colombian style."
"I really don't feel like dancing."
"No better reason to dance."
I thought for a moment. "Good point." She pressed the palm of her right hand against the palm of my left. She took my other hand and placed it on her hip. I could feel the warmth of her skin and the rhythm of her movement. Instantly, I was more connected to the music.
"Do you feel that?"
she asked. "How do you do that without even moving your feet?"
"Listen for the counter-rhythm."
"What's a counter-rhythm?" she smirked.
"You'd be pathetic if you weren't so cute. Follow my lead."
The guitar was booming in my head. I was trying so hard to concentrate. She moved one way, I moved opposite. "Sorry."
"That's okay," she said.
We tried again, and this time I was with her. She counted the steps for me aloud, then pushed my hand more firmly into her hip, as if to help me feel the motion.
"You got it," she said, smiling.
We moved back and forth, side to side, hips moving face to face. I crushed her foot once, but she just smiled and kept counting. After a full minute of no squished toes, her counting stopped.
"Look at you, you're dancing."
"I think I do have it," I said. Our guitar-playing friend was singing again, his voice stronger. The pace quickened, but I kept right up with it. Alex moved closer, shrinking the space between our bodies.
"You're pretty good for a gringo."
"Why do you say for a gringo?"
"Because a Colombian man would never let me lead."
"I think you'd lead if you were dancing with Fred Astaire."
"Fred who?"
"He's a famous..." She pinched my ribs, smiling.
"I know who he is. No se puede dar papaya," she added, her favorite expression.
"Don't be so naive," I said, translating.
"That's right," she said softly. "I might just walk all over you."
The music stopped, but we didn't pull apart. We remained in our dance pose, her right hand in my left. Slowly, her left hand slid from my hip toward my back, then up gently toward my shoulder blades. Instinctively, I did the same to her, my fingers traveling from the gentle curve of her hip to the small of her back. Our bodies drew closer, so close that the space between us was almost gone. I tingled with the imagined feeling of her breasts pressed against me. Her breath caressed my neck as she looked up at me, la mujer, with the dark brown eyes. She moved her hand across my back, caressing me. Almost involuntarily, I duplicated the light swirling motion across the warm, bare skin of her back. It was firm and very smooth, until the tips of my fingers found a slight ridge in the skin, then another ridge below it. Faded scars that I hadn't noticed before. Now that my touch had discovered them, I could actually see them as I looked past her shoulder at the reflection of her back in the window behind her. She stiffened in my arms, seeming to have sensed my discovery.
"Do they frighten you?"
"What?" I said, playing dumb.
"You found my scars, no?"
"They're nothing, really."
"You're lying."
I counted five of them, each an inch long and about a quarter inch wide. They appeared to be the remnants of old wounds that had never been treated properly. "It looks like you were stabbed."
"That's because I was."
She pulled away and stepped back as if suddenly self-conscious. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you."
"It's all right. It was a very long time ago. I was a 16-year-old girl."
"What happened?"
"I tried to quit FARC."
"They stab you for that?" It's a lifelong commitment. They don't like quitters. I tried not to look stunned. Isn't it dangerous for you to come back to Colombia?
For Sonia Bernal, yes. It would be very dangerous, if she were alive.
But she was stabbed 5 times in the back and left for dead in a gutter at the side of the road outside Cali almost 15 years ago. Sonia was your real name?
That was my FARC name.
And to answer your question, none of that seems real to me anymore. I'm beginning to know how you feel. She came toward me and patted me gently on the cheek, sort of symbolically slapping me out of my daze.
Don't worry, it only makes me tougher inside, more determined to get your father back. Good night, Nick.
I watched as she turned and headed back to her bedroom alone. I tried not to stare, but I was strangely fixated on the scars on her back. It was wild to think of her as having been one of them. For some reason, I thought back to that first day we'd spent together in Bogota when she'd snapped at me for trying to inject even the slightest diversion into her scheduled itinerary. To prove her point, she'd angrily driven me up to the top of the hill to see the once pleasant neighborhoods of northern Bogota that crime had transformed into little fortresses. I'd wondered back then if her concern went beyond my safety. Even now, I didn't know what to think, though one thing I was sure of. I'd never known a woman like Alex.
This ends Disc 8. A King's Ransom, Disc 9.
Chapter 51. Customs at Miami International Airport was a breeze. At least it was for Alex. She sailed through without a bag search, apparently an unmarried white male in his late 20s who'd made 2 very short trips between Miami and Colombia in the last month, set off all kinds of bells and whistles. My bags they wanted to see. I told Alex to go on without me.
You sure?
Yeah, we'll talk later. She was gone just a second before the customs agents exposed to the world my dependency on American-made toilet paper. I stuffed my personal items back in the bag, closed it up, and was ready to move on. "Would you mind coming with us, please?" asked the agent. I took a half step back, surprised. The elderly couple behind me took about 5 steps back, as if to announce that they weren't traveling with me. "What's this about?" "We'd like to ask you some questions. Could you please step out of the line?" At this point, my lawyerly instincts were kicking in, but I didn't want to make a scene. "Sure," I said. I grabbed my bag and followed the agent through an exit designated for airport employees and law enforcement. The agent used his electronic passkey to get us through another set of secure doors. On the other side was FBI agent Hewitt.
"Long time no see, Nick," he said.
His sidekick was with him, the young female agent who rarely said anything but looked as if she could break me in two if she'd wanted to. "Am I being detained?" I asked, knowing the legal significance of the word.
"Not at all," said Hewitt. "Just want to ask you some questions. You're free to go if you don't want to talk."
"Then it was nice talking to you," I said. "See you." As I turned, he said, "Where'd you get the $204,000? I stopped, but I didn't answer. 204 was the exact amount we'd wire transferred, even though we'd ended up paying only 100. He said, "Your Miami bank filled out a suspicious transaction report. You must have acted nervous when you went in to wire the money, Nick." "It's my money. If I want to wire it to Bogota and walk out of the bank with a suitcase full of cash, that's my business."
"Sure, so long as it really is your money.
For your sake, I hope it didn't come from your father's partner." The remark had me thinking of Alex's advice to borrow the full ransom from Guillermo. It didn't come from him.
"I promised to get you and your entire family full immunity if you'd help me expose Guillermo Cruz for what he is. No way in hell the U.S. attorney's going to go for that deal if you start spreading around dirty money.
I pulled together every penny of that money with help from no one but my closest friends. I mortgaged my house.
Spare me the sob story.
Then spare me the grief. We don't need your immunity.
Let me give you a little advice. You keep crawling around with snakes. You're going to get bitten. It happened to your old man. It can happen to you.
What do you know about my father? He stepped closer and spoke in a low, threatening tone.
I know that kidnappings like this one are rarely a case of an innocent person being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I know that your father went down to Colombia with 5 Nicaraguans to buy 3 shrimp boats that I suspect haven't been used for shrimping in a very long time. I know all about the people he bought the boats from, and I know how vindictive they can be when someone double-crosses them in their particularly unseemly line of commerce. What do you know about your father, Nick?
His words hung in the air, more an accusation than a question. I looked at him coldly and said,
"Enough to know that you're totally full of shit."
I picked up my bag and walked out the door. From the airport, I drove straight downtown to the Miami-Dade County Courthouse. Though I'd refused to let him see it, Hewitt had gotten to me. He made me realize that no matter how badly I needed the ransom, Guillermo really wasn't an option. I had to do everything possible to get the money out of Quality Insurance Company. I reached the courthouse just a few minutes before the lunch hour, and I planted myself at the top of the tiered granite steps at the south entrance to the building. In the shadows of massive stone columns, I waited. Though she clearly hadn't remembered me, I'd second-chaired a week-long trial in front of Judge Corvin about 8 months earlier, which meant that I did little more than carry the trial bags back and forth from the courthouse to the offices of Cool Cash. If nothing else, the experience had taught me that Judge Corvin was a creature of habit when it came to the lunch hour. I knew she'd be passing by any minute on her way to the Boston sub shop. "Judge Corvin," I called out. She kept walking, donning her huge dark sunglasses. I followed her down the first tier of steps, calling her name once more. She slowed her pace but didn't stop. "I'm Nick Ray," I said, walking alongside her.
"I know who you are."
We passed the hot dog cart on the street, then continued to the crosswalk. For an older woman, she walked at quite a clip.
"I have to talk to you, Judge. Is this what I think it's about?" "My father's case against Quality Insurance." "Then stop right there. You have a new judge.
Are you aware that the case has been put on hold?"
"I have nothing to say about that."
The light changed, and we continued across busy Flagler Street. "Do you think that's a fair result?"
"I've recused myself. It doesn't matter what I think.
It matters to me.
It's completely inappropriate for you to confront me this way."
"You're right, but I'm running out of options."
"Maybe I should report you to the Florida Bar, and we can see what they think.
Maybe I should invite you to my father's funeral, so that it's clear I don't care what they think." She stopped cold on the sidewalk.
"Did something happen?"
"It's about to. I have a week to raise $3 million or they're going to kill him." From the look on her face, I could see that I'd pegged her correctly. She had a well-known reputation for fairness, and I'd sensed that she was a woman of compassion.
"I wish I could help you, but I can't."
"Why did you remove yourself from the case?"
"I can't tell you that."
"Judge, a man's life is at stake here." Cars were passing in the street, a steady flow of pedestrians racing by us on the sidewalk. She seemed edgy.
"This discussion should not be taking place."
"I know what the rules of ethics say."
"I'm not talking about the rules of ethics," she said in a hushed but urgent voice. "I'm telling you this for your own good and mine. This conversation should not be taking place."
Her tone chilled me. I thought I knew what she was telling me, but I wasn't sure. "Are you saying that you stepped down because
every judge has skeletons in her closet? They found mine."
I stood mute. She clearly had more of a conscience than I'd thought, and the shocking candor was perhaps her way of apologizing for having bailed out of my father's case. She touched my hand and said,
"Watch yourself, young man. Quality Insurance Company does not intend to lose this case."
With that, she left me. She was well out of earshot by the time I uttered my reply. "Neither do I," I said, beneath my breath. I cut across Flagler Street to my Jeep. Chapter 52. Matthew got a new pair of boots. Replacement boots was a more apt description. They were better than the old ones, but definitely not new.
He recognized them as the Swedes. What happened to Jan? He asked the gorilla. It was the fat guy with the tattoo on his face, Serdo.
He's gone.
Home? He smirked, then said with a chuckle,
Yeah, home. Now, let's go.
Where to?
You'll see.
Matthew rose slowly. He didn't like the vibes, but he tried to be rational. They wouldn't have brought him a better pair of boots just to take him out and shoot him.
Bring everything with you.
Everything?
Are you deaf? Yes, everything.
Matthew pulled on the boots and buttoned his coat. It was a cold morning, so he was already wearing every stitch of clothing he owned. Two shirts, a pair of pants, a wool sweater, and a knit cap that one of the gorillas had pitched aside because it was too full of holes. He also had two pairs of socks, one for his feet and one that served as mittens on really cold nights. He looked around his sleep area beneath the canvas tarp, making a mental inventory of everything. Beyond the clothes on his back, there wasn't much. He unfastened the tarp from the trees and shook out the water. He rolled his blanket inside and strapped the bundle to his back. He felt like a Great Depression-era hobo about to hop a train.
"Got it all?" asked the gorilla.
"That's everything.
Make sure we're not coming back."
"What a pity," said Matthew. Matthew's spot was down the hill from the gorilla's main hut. He followed Serdo up the path, then stopped short, startled by what sounded like machine-gun fire in the distance. It was faint, but he recognized the sounds from his tour in Vietnam.
"What's the shooting?"
"Chulos,"
he replied. That was the guerrilla's word for the Colombian army. Was the army moving in for a rescue? That had been Matthew's first thought, but his hope faded quickly. Rescue didn't seem possible. This place was too remote. It had to be just another skirmish in the decades-old war between the army and the leftist guerrillas. Or the guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries. Or the guerrillas and some group of Ecuadorian or Peruvian bandits. Or a turf war between FARC and the ELN. Or right-wing extremists dragging unarmed campesinos into the street and murdering them in front of their families just because they were suspected of being sympathetic to the guerrillas. Out here, there were just so many ways to get killed in the crossfire. They reached the hut at the top of the hill. Matthew followed the gorilla to the front, then stopped short at the sight. The camp had been completely transformed. Joaquin and his men were standing to one side, guns in hand and their packs strapped to their backs. Several dozen other guerrillas, men and women whom Matthew didn't recognize, had taken positions around the hut, including a long trench that they dug and fortified with fallen trees. Near the hut, guerrillas were rolling black ink onto their weapons and striping their faces with black grease paint. Someone was anticipating some night fighting. From the dragon insignia on the fatigues, Matthew recognized them as FARC.
"Sit here," said Serdo.
Matthew quickly searched for the driest patch of earth and seated himself in front of the hut to the right of the door.
"Matthew,"
someone whispered. He peered around the corner of the hut and spotted Emilio, the Colombian prisoner, seated along the side of the hut just a few feet away.
"What's going on?" asked Matthew.
"Army's getting close. FARC's gearing up for a battle."
"I thought Joaquin wasn't part of FARC."
"He's not. They're kicking him out of their territory. FARC commanders put up with him so long as he was selling his kidnap victims to them, but he's been asking for too much money lately."
"Where are the other captives?"
"FARC took them."
"What?"
"I think it's like back rent. Joaquin's been a squatter on their turf, so they just took four of his prisoners. They let him keep two."
"Why us?"
"Just a guess on my part. Joaquin thinks I'm the least trouble and you're worth the most money."
It sickened Matthew to think that things were so bad with Joaquin, he almost wished he'd been sold to FARC.
"Up," said the gorilla. It was a girl this time.
Serdo was gone. At gunpoint, she marched Matthew and Emilio across the busy camp toward Joaquin and the rest of his band. Joaquin was in a serious-looking conversation with one of the FARC commanders. They were checking a map, apparently deciding on the best way out. Matthew glanced back toward the hut. From about 30 meters away, he caught sight of Nisho and the Colombian woman seated on the ground near the campfire. On the other side of the fire, closer to Matthew, Serdo was talking with two FARC guerrillas. He was laughing and pointing back toward the women. Finally, he got down on his knees, hands together in the praying position, whining and begging in Spanish, "Please stop, you're hurting me." The men all laughed, but Cerdo laughed hardest, and Matthew realized what was happening. He was recounting their rape of Nisho, as if telling the FARC boys what they had to look forward to. Joaquin called his men together. He had his map, and he apparently had FARC's blessing on his way out. Turning over Nisho and the Colombian woman had guaranteed his rite of passage.
"Vamos," said Joaquin.
Cerdo came running along, his belly bouncing. Matthew glanced back one last time at their camp, toward the two women prisoners. He thought of his own wife and daughter and felt an almost uncontrollable urge to grab a gun and do the right thing. But between Joaquin's group of bandits and the FARC guerrillas, he would have been killed before firing a single shot.
"Te amo, Nisho!"
shouted Cerdo. A chorus of laughter followed from Joaquin and the others who'd been at the river that day. Filled with anger, Matthew forced himself to put one foot in front of the other as they marched down the side of the mountain. He didn't know where they were going, and it no longer mattered. At that moment, he vowed that wherever they ended up, he'd seize the first opportunity. He'd kill Joaquin first, Cerdo second. Whoever else he could take with him would just be gravy. Chapter 53. I'd wanted to sleep on things, but that night was fitful. I needed $3 million. Time was short.